There was no physical connection to our eyes, but there was a spiritual dynamism that eluded the physical eye, and this dynamism enabled the arm to be articulated. This was proof that we were in the presence of a materialized spirit. Next, after a brief conversation, the spirit announced that she was going to give some treatment to Jaisor's wife, who was suffering from cancer of the uterus, for which Romanelli states she had been examined and x-rayed. Sheila told her to lie down and began to give her longitudinal passes. What impressed me most was that as she did so, sparks began to fly from her fingers, as bright as those of a voltaic arc, lighting up the room as if under very strong lightning. The light was blinding. Later, Romanelli continues, I learned that the patient was examined again by doctors after her treatment by the spirit, with both x-rays and biopsy revealing no trace of cancer. This was in 1948, and the woman died early in 1972. Romanelli next asked the spirit for some information on how the materialization effect was produced. Psychical researchers may be wondering at this stage why he did not ask all sorts of other questions as well, but they must remember that Brazilian spiritists are on the whole not in the least concerned with inflicting their beliefs on others, and we are lucky that Romanelli asked any questions at all, remembered the answers he was given, and was prepared to discuss them later. She made a comparison that struck me as quite convincing, he continues. She reminded us of the experiment we used to make in the physics and chemistry labs at school, where you scatter iron filings on a piece of paper with an electromagnet underneath, and when you switch on the current, the filings take the form of the so-called field of the magnet. She said the same thing took place in the case of materializations. The spirit makes use of matter, orienting the ectoplasm exteriorized by the medium, and using it to mold the form and structure through which it materializes itself. In the case of death, or dematerialization, the elements are reabsorbed so that the structure is totally dissolved. I was struck by the fact that at this point the room was not dark at all, we could see each other quite clearly, and as the spirit dematerialized it gradually became darker until once again we were in complete darkness. In addition to Sheila, Dr. Romanelli was able to make the acquaintance of another regular spirit member of the Paixoteno group, a jovial fellow called Jose Grosso, a Northeasterner who was fond of playing innocent little jokes on people and generally having fun. On this occasion, Grosso did not materialize fully, confining himself to what spiritists call an ectoplasmic throat, or their minimum human anatomy required to produce audible sounds. Grosso, of whom I had never heard, announced that he was preparing a surprise for me. He asked me to say something from the Gospels, anything I liked. I said something or other, I forget what, but the spirit said it was too long, and asked me for a shorter phrase. So I said I am the light of the world, and he replied yes, that's good, that'll do. Wait a minute. So I waited for something to happen, and then he told me to go to the back of the room, which I did. Then I saw a luminous focal point coming towards me, taking shape as it came. When it was about 1 meter away, I could see it was a panel suspended in midair, the kind you see hanging outside commercial stores, and on it was written I am the light of the world. Jesus. A few other phenomena took place, including the manifestation of a voice that seemed to dart around the room while it was speaking, but the appearance of Sheila and Jose Grosso were enough to convince Romanelli of the reality of spirit materialization. He pointed out that Paixoteno had been plainly visible to all present for much of the evening, the windows had been tightly closed, and the group was made up of a small number of close personal friends. He summed up the effect the session had on him at the time in a single word that means overwhelmed, amazed or fascinated, deslumbrado exclamation mark 4, Newton Bochat's testimony, a small portion of which has been published, is of particular interest in that he attended a great many sessions with Paixoteno, managing to keep calm while the most amazing things were going on, asking questions and remembering the replies. He begins by defining some terms and questioning the correctness of the word materialization in this context. In my view, the word is not right, he says, referring to an appearance made by Dr. Bizarro de Menezes, who died in 1900, at a Rio de Janeiro session held in 1957. It was a densification in concrete light, for the spirit body was lit from head to foot, with no trace of shadows. The whole body was entirely radiant, like an alabaster statue suddenly illuminated from within, so that the light overflowed beyond the limits of the perispirit and lit up the whole room. He stayed with us, concretized in brilliant light, for 8 to 10 minutes. He spoke for a few moments about earthly life, touching some sick people with a baton he carried, at the end of which there was a blue light. The room became so light that I could easily have seen to read the small print of a newspaper, if I had wanted to. He spoke very clearly, on the subject of immortality and the opportunities we have for innovation. The appearance of Dr. Bizarre had been preceded by a small light the size of an orange which had zigzagged round the room and then disappeared. This seems to be one of the two ways spirits announce their impending condensation down to our plane. The other, which Beauchat also witnessed, is the lightning effect already described by Dr. Ranieri. Beauchat saw this at a session at which Sheila appeared, though he points out that her way of appearing was not always the same. I was sitting on a chair close to the cabin where the medium was asleep. Then the typical flashes of lightning began, Paik Sotino having already exteriorized abundant ectoplasm. The flashes began intermittently, on and off, then stabilized themselves and became normal. Suddenly we saw a female entity with long tresses. I couldn't say it was Sheila, as she was entirely black from top to bottom, her blackness contrasting with what light there was in the room. By light here, he means that although the session had begun in total darkness, the lightning flashes had become almost continuous, keeping the room illuminated. She left the medium's side and went over to a mirror, where she seemed to be making herself up as if to improve her appearance. When she came out of the cabin, it was as if coal had been transformed into diamonds. She was gleaming all over. That was when we could see it was Sheila. It was like seeing a photograph before and after development. I didn't know why this was done and never found out. In retrospect, I am sure that what Beauchat means here is the difference between a negative and positive photograph. On another occasion, at which Chico Xavier was present, Beauchat noticed that Sheila, who had appeared in all her usual radiance, seemed to go opaque as she walked past a row of 4 or 5 people sitting together. We asked Chico Xavier why this happened, and he said she was passing by some businessman whose thoughts at that moment had not been turned towards spiritual matters, and that Sheila had felt restrained by the vibratory magnetic impact of their mental irradiations. When she moved closer to people more concerned with spiritual matters, or to people who were suffering, she began to glow again. How often at healing sessions have I heard exhortations to fix the thoughts on Jesus, especially while a difficult operation was in progress? Can our silent minds really be capable of causing turmoil on the spirit plane? Evidence seems to indicate that they can. It shows, says Beauchat, referring to this incident, that you cannot overlook the moral factor in psychical research. He is not the first person to make this often overlooked point. The advice given by Sir William Barrett over 50 years ago is worth repeating here. Too many investigators forget that the mental atmosphere they bring is almost as important as the part played by the medium. It does not occur to them that their cooperation is necessary. No advance in any branch of science would have been possible if the investigator set out not to elicit truth, but with the determination to expose what he considered was fraud. Moreover, in psychical research, a medium is a sensitive instrument that reacts to its environment. A sitter who is suspicious, or who plays the fool, may entirely inhibit the production of any phenomena. 5. On another occasion, Barrett wrote, psychical researchers need sympathy with their subject, whereas scientific workers do not, and his own remarkable success in both fields suggests that he knew what he was talking about. 6. I hardly need mention the obvious corollary, that too much sympathy with the subject may turn one into an uncritical apologist for the cause, ignoring inconvenient evidence for the sake of proving one's ardently desired hypothesis. I am well aware of this dichotomy that must face all researchers in all fields, And since none of us is perfect, I would rather err on the side of credulousness, albeit as little as possible. This is at least a positive attitude, whereas skepticism is not. But let us get back to Newton Bochat, who has plenty more to say. First, here he is describing the evening he had his throat treated by the spirit nurse, Sheila. She took me by the hand into the cabin and told me to lie down. She was not totally materialized, perhaps to save the medium's energy or possibly because she did not need to be. As she was talking to me, I could see she was only materialized as far as her bust. She stretched out her right hand, and something like an insecticide spray appeared mysteriously. She pumped it once or twice into my throat, and instantly I felt freezing cold inside. Before this, she had stuffed some cotton wool into my tonsils, and this became extremely hot, upon which she took it out. The heat was outside and the cold inside, rather like when you rub yourself with vapor up. It's hot at the time but feels cold afterwards. Sheila was mobile and vital. She would nod her head back and forth, throwing her hair back. She was very beautiful. She reminded me of Jean Harlow. She said my throat would get better, and it did. I had an operation scheduled, and cancelled it. Now, I can drink cold drinks with no trouble. Next, Bochat describes some of Sheila's medical appliances, of which we have already had tantalizing glimpses from Dr. A. Neary and Dr. Romain Nelly. The portable X-ray device he recalls as being in the shape of a yam leaf, with a surface like stainless steel and slightly flexible. Sheila brought one along and placed it on a sick person's stomach. Through this substance, we could see the organs and the glands working, in their natural colors, moving as observed in ordinary research. Sometimes, the apparatus would go opaque, and then light up again. It was less bright in color than Rainieri describes it, perhaps because on this occasion the medium was suffering from a cold and had less power. On another occasion, Bochat recalls that Sheila used an invisible instrument for a long treatment session that lasted nearly an hour. It sounded like a lighter, being flicked on repeatedly, but nothing was seen of it. Yet another piece of equipment, which resembled a lipstick capsule, was brought along by Sheila at a session held in a Pedro Leopoldo bedroom, not the one described by Rainieri, with Pake Sotino asleep on a single bed in full view of his companions. Sheila put the thing on his stomach, explaining that it contained energies withdrawn from what she called the psychosphere of our planet to help the medium avoid attacks of bronchitis while work was going on. Pake Sotino suffered much of his life from asthma, and would occasionally start to cough during trance. This would invariably interrupt proceedings. On one such occasion, Bochat was watching a materialized handwriting on a piece of paper under the light of a glowing ball 15 to 20 centimeters in diameter. As the medium began to cough, the hand shot back into the cabin as if on the end of a piece of elastic. Bochat noted a number of details that check with what many other witnesses of various forms of seance have reported. On numerous occasions the room would be impregnated with an intoxicating perfume, while the temperature would often drop sharply. In Rio de Janeiro, where room temperature even at night can be as high as 90 degrees F, Bochat had the impression of being in the mountain climate of Petropolis, at least 20 degrees cooler. This may be an exaggeration, since there is so little variation in Rio temperatures, people that tend to feel even slight changes very acutely. 1 or 2 degrees difference can make them complain of the heat, or the cold, as the case may be. Bochat also had the honor of having a spiritual signboard made for him by the ever-playful José Grosso. He asked how this was done, but Grosso merely laughed. He said he would show me when I came over to his side. Bochat recalls. Finally, after so much discussion of materialization, or as he prefers to call it, structuring in light, Newton Bochat has a further surprise in store. Would you believe dematerialization of the medium? Breaking my strict rule of not using third-hand material, I will simply let Bochat tell this story in his own words as he learned it from friends at the center run by Jesors, a prominent member of the Rainieri Circle. The medium in question was not Peixoto this time, but Fabio Mercado, who enjoyed an equally high reputation in spiritist circles and who often helped materialize the same spirits as those of the Peixoto sessions. Somebody had placed a cloth over the illuminated dial of the record player rather carelessly, and while a spirit was materialized it fell off. The spirit immediately vanished and the voice broke off, while the medium began to groan. Two or three people rushed over to see what they could do to help. As they were giving him passes, they felt his body and noticed that he was dematerialized from the waist down. His pajamas were still there, but there was simply no continuation of the body. Then the voice of the entity Jose Grosso announced that Fabio was indeed dematerialized from the waist down, and that the resources for his reintegration were pulverized in the room, or stretched out as if in sustaining threads, dissociated from the physical body. They would, he said, try to reharmonize the room, calm the minds of those present and make an adaptation, a fitting together of millions of cells in the model. The dynamic structure raw perispiritual body of the medium. The operation lasted about 50 to 60 minutes, and Fabio was totally restored to the power of his body. But a very curious thing happened. This was before the days of plastic surgery, in Brazil, and everyone knew that Fabio had a gash on his right thigh in a childhood accident, and that the scar had remained fully visible. Well, in the materialization of his body, the scar completely disappeared, as if some skillful plastic surgeon had just rooted it out while reaccommodating the cells around the lines of force of the dynamic body. This story is well known and widely believed in Brazilian spiritist circles, and may account for many mediums' insistence upon working in complete darkness. One appreciates their point of view. One of the many things I learned while working with the IBPP is that no case should ever be closed. New evidence can always turn up, as it did after The Flying Cow was published, and I was going around Britain promoting it on radio and television. One of my readers was Dr. John Biloff of Edinburgh University, a distinguished parapsychologist and active member of the Society for Psychical Research, of whose journal he was to become editor. He kindly invited me to lunch when I passed through the Scottish capital, and gave me a courteous but thorough grilling on some of the strange things I had described in the book. He was especially fascinated by my account of the materializations produced by Peixoto, and by the testimony of Professor Romanelli, then working at UNESCO in Paris. Biloff decided to contact Romanelli and see how he felt nearly 30 years after his encounter with the medium. Romanelli replied promptly at some length and in near-perfect English, reaffirming his earlier account of his 1948 session. After summarizing the phenomena described above, he concluded uncompromisingly, "I have an absolute conviction that the phenomenon we witnessed was real. I felt precisely conscious at the time it occurred, and according to testimony from each present during the sitting, what I saw and heard was equally seen and heard by all of them. I should like to add that there is not one proof that the medium Peixoto has ever been caught in fraud." Peixoto, like Chico Xavier and Fabio Mercado, is an example of what we might call the classic Brazilian medium, one whose entire life is devoted to the cause of propagating spiritism without seeking or accepting any kind of financial reward. Not all mediums in Brazil, however, have managed to withstand pressures and remain unaffected by success and popularity, and in the following two chapters we take a look at a couple of mediums who were very well known in their time. It might be unfair to say that we are passing from the sublime to the ridiculous, but we can certainly say that we are passing from the sublime to the rather less sublime. So, with a suitably operatic flourish from the orchestra, enter Mirabile. 2. Mirabile. If everything they say about Carmen Mirabile is true, he was without doubt the most spectacular physical effects medium in history. If anything they say about him is true, he should not be omitted from any survey of the psychic scene in Brazil, and since hearing some of the things they were still saying about him more than 20 years after his death, I find it difficult to think of his name without a pair of exclamation marks after it. For Mirabile was surely the medium to end all mediums. You name it, and he is said to have done it, automatic writing in over 30 languages living or dead, speaking in numerous foreign tongues, materializing objects and people, transporting anything from a bunch of flowers to large pieces of furniture, including levitation of himself even when strapped to a chair, producing impressions of spirit hands in trays of flour or wax inside locked drawers, dematerializing anything in sight, himself included. He could, they say, contact dead relatives of friends and paint portraits of them. He could sing and play the piano or violin with considerable skill while in trance, although he had no musical talent or training. He could write a message of several pages in a few minutes while chatting away at the same time in another language. He did, in fact, just about everything that any other medium has ever done, doing so for something like 40 years. Moreover, he normally did his thing in broad daylight or in a well-lit room in front of anything up to 500 witnesses. He seemed to have no objections to having his house searched or to being handcuffed and tied to a chair, or to being investigated, up to a point, by all and sundry. Fortunately for posterity, many of his feats were witnessed by a great many people, some of whom were still able to recall them for me in detail more than 20 years after his death. Two of his closest friends published a great deal of material on him, based on minutes of meetings at the various centers where he held forth. These were Miguel Kahl, a businessman of German descent who spent a year in India with Swami Yogananda Saraswati, and Yuriko de Goes, pronounced Goes, a highly literate and intelligent man who became organizer and director of São Paulo's first municipal public library. De Goes, one of Brazil's first serious psychical researchers, had a special reason for attaching himself to Myra Bealey. His attractive wife had died young, and he was forever trying to make contact with her. Though he never managed a complete materialization, he satisfied himself that she really had contacted him through Myra Bealey's mediumship on a number of occasions, in the course of which he witnessed and described more than 100 materializations of other entities. Some of these lasted over an hour, allowing themselves to be examined by doctors and prodded all over. Myra Bealey was, de Goes concluded, a veritable laboratory for the researcher, and though he was not researched anything like as thoroughly as he should have been, we must be grateful to his faithful Boswell for the great trouble he took to record his hero's feats. There is a large amount of literature on Myra Bealey, but little of it apart from de Goes's well-written 471-page tome is of any value to modern researchers. Much of the information in this chapter is based on it, except where otherwise specified. 1. Myra Bealey was in his lifetime, and remains today, a highly controversial figure, and since his death the legend has expanded in all directions. Many stories told about him are almost certainly untrue or gross exaggerations, yet even when these have been discounted, as many were before the writing of this chapter, there remains a residue of evidence that suggests he deserves his place here. Carmen Myra Bealey, who later called himself Carlos to avoid confusion with the Brazilian female name Carmen, was born in 1889 in the town of Botucatu, some 160 miles from São Paulo. His father was a well-to-do Protestant pastor from Italy, whom de Goes generously describes as a man with the kindest heart although imbued with Lutheran doctrines, and amongst his many illustrious ancestors were said to be a president of the Italian royal court, an army general and a parliamentary deputy. He was educated in his hometown and at a primary school in the nearby town of Itu, where he showed a precocious intellect, although like many sons of immigrants he never quite mastered either his ancestors or his adopted country's language. He learned some English and possibly also some German, but certainly became no skilled linguist. He showed an early ability after leaving school for making money, in a deal involving a large consignment of gas mantles from Germany, and throughout his life he never had to rely on his mediumship to earn a good living, mostly by buying and selling land. He undoubtedly charged for his services on some occasions, one of his own leaflets clearly stating his very large fee for personal consultations, but it is also quite certain that he gave a lot of money away and was a generous and kind-hearted person. his mediumship seems to have hit him, literally, while he was in his early 20s, working in the Clark shoe store in Sao Paulo. According to often repeated, and equally often denied, legend, boxes of shoes would fly off their shelves, while the young salesman would be seized by bouts of chills, visions, depression, neurasthenia and assorted other fits. Obviously, he had to leave, and it is said that when he did, some of the shoe boxes went out into the street after him. The general opinion was that young Carmen had gone crazy, and he was duly committed to the Jacquerie Asylum for the Insane, where he was closely observed by two doctors, Felipe Ake and Franco de Rocha, after whom the asylum is now named. "He is not a normal man," Dr. Ake declared, "but nor is he sick." Referring to the strange things that were beginning to happen whenever Myra Bealey was around, he decided they were the result of the radiation of nervous forces that we all have, but that senior Myra Bealey has in extraordinary excess. Dr. Franco D.A. Rocha later described what kind of a show Myra Bealey could put on even at this early stage of his career. "He placed a skull on top of a glass, and at my request it began to revolve, so that at a given moment both skull and glass fell over on the table. I replaced the objects in their former positions, and the phenomenon was repeated. I did so yet again, and the same thing happened. Nor was that all. As I held the skull, I felt something strange in my hands, something fluid, as if a globular liquid were touching my palm. When I concentrated my attention further, I saw something similar to an irradiation pass over the skull, as when you rapidly expose a mirror to luminous rays." After a stay of only 19 days, Myra Bealey was let out of Jacquerie Asylum and went to live in the seaside town of Santos. Here, he became the representative of a homeopathic medicine company and opened his own charitable organization, the São Luís House of Charity. Miguel Carl records that this was kept going for 14 years at a total cost to its founder of 751,000 milreis, during which time donations amounted to only 12,628 milreis. Photographs of the center show that it was well attended by hordes of both rich and poor in search of physical or psychical diagnoses. For such an organization to last so long is quite a feat in Brazil, where spiritist centers can appear and disappear almost overnight. Yuriko de Goes knew Myra Bealey well for over 20 years, after they first met by chance in a São Paulo hotel in 1916. He describes him as a typical Italian, excitable, impulsive and impatient, but also tolerant and warm-hearted, a lover of good food, animals and opera. He led a somewhat bohemian life, being especially fond of going for long drives at night in the countryside. He was a big spender, who would think nothing of buying 10 suits or a dozen pairs of shoes at a time, only to give most of them away. Yet despite his flamboyance and evident vanity, two qualities notably lacking in orthodox Brazilian spiritists, Myra Bealey fully embraced the spiritist cause, founding and running a number of centers in São Paulo and Rio de Janeiro. One of these was nominally headed by a distinguished public health official, Dr. Thade de Medeiros. Though one of the main purposes of these various centers seems to have been to promote Myra Bealey himself, many who attended them were converted to spiritism as a result. Modern spiritists in Brazil certainly do not approve of Myra Bealey or his methods, but they grant that he was an effective evangelist. Throughout his career as a medium, Myra Bealey was regularly witnessed by doctors and scientists, several of whose names are attached to the minutes of meetings reprinted by de Goes. He was also watched at work by a popular conjurer, Carlos Gardon Ramos, who stated that it is entirely impossible for these phenomena to be achieved by sleight of hand. Foreign observers who saw him in action at least once at various stages of his life included Bruno Heckmann and Johann Reichenbach from Berlin, Italian chemist Tito Guarneri, envoys May Walker and Theodore Besterman from the American and British Societies for Psychical Research respectively, and most important of all, the eminent Leipzig philosopher and SPR president, 1926-27, Hans Driesch. May Walker described the best telekinesis I have ever seen after a comparatively mild session in which rose petals floated from the ceiling, bottles jumped up and down on a table, and a fan began to wriggle about, as if alive in her hand, while her hat went round in circles on her head.